Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're going to talk today with one of our great writers here in America who's come out with a new book called Blood's a Rover, which is just a phenomenal novel, the end of the Underworld USA trilogy. You know him from maybe seeing the movies made out of his books, like The Black Dahlia and L.A. Confidential and others. He's written many, many books, many articles, got this series running in Playboy, and joins us here right now. And James Elroy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Mark the Shark. What's shaking, baby?
Just trying to hang in there, like the rest of us. Get it through this.
Words out in the underworld, Shark. You give good fin.
I do my best. So yeah. This book, there's so much to say about all this. I've been looking forward to this for a while, having read a lot of your stuff in the past. And this particular, though, this Blood's a Rover, is really an interesting end to your Underworld USA trilogy. I mean, 68 to 72.
Yeah, it was a hell of a time, and I was there.
I was there, too. So it was a hell of a time. For our listeners who have not seen the other two parts of this trilogy, talk about this kind of leap into this 10 years that you took, whatever it is, more than that, 12 years. Isn't it 12?
Volume 1. Yeah. I've been on this work 14 years. Volume 1, American Tabloid, goes 58 to 63. That's largely the rise and fall of JFK. Book 2, The Cold 6000, 63 to 68, that's my big novel of the American 60s. The new book, which readers should read first, Blood's a Rover, goes 68 to 72, ends at the eve of Watergate. You got fallout from the RFK and MLK hits. You got bad right-wing toadies falling in love with strong left-wing women. You got gay Edgar Hoover attempting to infiltrate black militant groups in Southside L.A., the Black Tribal Alliance and the Mau Mau Liberation Front. You've got voodoo in Haiti. You've got revolution in the Dominican Republic. You've got Howard Hughes, Dracula, trying to buy up Las Vegas. You've got bad juju all over the globe, and you're there for all of it.
And
this book.
You are there for all of it. And one of the things this book, though it's different than some of the other books I've read that you've written, in that there's a lot of, I don't know, actually exploring people's feelings in a way, in a different kind of depth about reconsidering who they are, reconsidering what I've done.
Yes, this is a more introspective book. It's a less frenetically paced book. It's a less stylistically rigorous book. It's calculatedly more accessible, it's more reader-friendly, and it's about ideology, and it's about revolution, and it's about conversion, and it's about spiritual change. It's a reflective book.
The ideological part's really interesting, because people have tried to label you in the past as a right-winger. You've read all this stuff.
Oh, sure.
But life is more complex than that, and so are you, I imagine.
Yes, I'm not a left-winger. I'm not a right-winger. I'm an egalitarian theocrat, if I'm anything.
An egalitarian theocrat? Is that what you said?
Yeah, and I'm out to bewilder people with Blood's a Rover.
But I think it's – I mean, clearly, you're one of those people who takes a lot out of his own world to write. And
it's very, very true. Blood's a Rover is a tremendous inward journey for me. It's Beethoven in that sense. I've never been to Haiti or the Dominican Republic. I looked at some pictures. That was sufficient. History's been very kind to me. For example, there was no discernible Nixon administration policy toward the Dominican Republic or Haiti. Thus, I had that much more latitude to fictionalize. In the end, you just make it up.
The end, you just make it up. There's so many parts of this book, though, you don't know whether you're reading real history when you have the documents coming out of the FBI or the other stuff that you pop up through the book, and where the line is between reality and fiction.
Yeah, and that's the one question, Shark, that I never answer is what's real and what's not. I'll give you an example. Don Crutchfield,
right,
the hero of the book, the young wheelman, the young private eye, the window peeper, is a real guy. He's a friend of mine. And we have an agreement for him to appear as the hero of this book. There's a lot of stuff he did, a lot of stuff he didn't do. Neither Crutch nor I are going to tell you exactly which is which.
I mean, whether Crutch actually did blow away people in the Dominican Republic.
He was certainly a wheel man for felonious private eyes. Clyde Duber's a real character. Freddie Otash is a real character. Phil Irwin is a real character. Gay Edgar Hoover. Slippery Dick Nixon. Dracula, Howard Hughes, so all those guys.
When a writer takes these people's histories and puts them in places that some people speculate but nobody really knows.
Right.
I mean, is that a dangerous ground to tread?
If you can create verisimilitude by providing readers with the private infrastructure of big public events, they will believe you. Subtext is the key to writing great historical fiction. You don't need to see JFK give his Ich bin ein Berliner speech. It's in our gourds already as
right.
Subtext. Better to show him in bed, and he was a two-minute man, with an FBI-planted call girl and some ghoul feds listening from the listening post a few blocks away. We know that.
But what I mean is when we paint these pictures of these guys, I mean, COINTELPRO was real. I mean, going after black groups and radical revolutionary groups in the 60s was very real, with J. Edgar Hoover and kind of undermining it and destroying people. That really happened.
Right.
People speculated about the relationship between Richard Nixon and the mob and doing things for money. But you haven't flat out taken this money.
Yeah, he's taken the envelope.
So
he's looking the other way. Pardon Jimmy Hoffa. Lay off the boys.
Right.
Let us plan our casinos in the Dominican Republic.
Right.
Is it real? Is it falsity? I'm not saying. Well, it's close.
Well, where does it come from for you? That's what I want to know. I want to know.
I read research briefs. I lock myself in a room. And I ignore popular culture. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have a computer. I am computer illiterate.
Ah.
I don't go to movies, watch television, or read newspapers. I ignore the culture. Holy moly, I was in the restaurant at the hotel this morning,
yeah,
having a cup of coffee, and I hear some people talking at the next table, and they tell me a black guy was elected president. I couldn't believe it.
Now, you, man, I know you're not that out of it.
I'm out of it. I'm out of it. And you just want to get back to the aquarium and find some women and give them some righteous fin, Chuck.
That was my ref once, but
I've got you under my fin.
But now, so you really do cut yourself off from the world, don't you? I mean, in a very serious way.
I do. I lie in the dark and talk to women who aren't in the room with me, but I just met a woman who's the love of my life.
You have, for real?
Yeah, for real.
That's a good thing. Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm happy.
That's good.
Yeah, I'll take it.
I mean, because I've read this lying in the room and kind of talking to women who aren't there and thinking about these incredible women you've been with before and the world you've gone through, and now it happened.
Yeah.
So she'll appear in a novel sometime in the future?
She will be in my memoir, The Hilliker Curse, which will be published by Alfred A. Knopf next fall.
This is a serial that's on Playboy right now, right?
Yes, The Hilliker Curse, four parts in Playboy. It's in the April, June, September, and coming up, the conclusion in November.
And tell folks a bit about that, would you? What you're doing with
I'm that? Obsessed with women.
Yes.
Here's the deal. I was obsessed with women before my mother was murdered when I was 10 years old. I'm a perv. I was popping around looking in windows when I was 9 years old. It gave me something to do. It gave me something to do for a long time. Then my mother was murdered on June 22nd, 1958. I already wrote about that in my memoir, My Dark Places. This is the companion piece. It's even more profound.
So, but clearly, I mean, every time I read that about you, I just think about, shit, I mean, being 10 years old, your mom being murdered, spending your life kind of trying to find out what really happened to her, never really being able to find out.
Yeah, we're never going to know. We're never going to know who killed the Black Dahlia or JFK. We're all going to get used to it. It's all right.
It's all right, except it does turn your head.
It turned my head, yeah. It's got my snout, you know, securely down there sniffing out the air. It evinced a certain precocity in me. I had a sense very early on, age 10, 1958, that there were really two stories extant with every alleged one story. And it's one of the reasons why I love history so much. I've always sensed that in the long corridors leading up to the Oval Office, say in Tricky Dick Nixon's administration, there was a man with an attaché case and a silencer gun inside it. I want to know that guy's story. That is Blood's a Rover.
That is Blood's a Rover. Yeah. It is Blood's Rover. I'm going to get to the heart of Blood's Rover. I just wanted to ask you a question as I leap into that, since this is part of that period. I mean, in 68, you were 20, right?
That's correct.
And you were a caddy.
Were you a caddy then? I wasn't a caddy then. Yeah, no. I was just a perv and a panty sniffer and a layabout and a punk kid.
Actually, the caddy came later.
So
let me ask you a question. I've never seen you. I'm just curious. Were you in the Army? How did you not get drafted and go to Nam?
I was briefly in the Army. I got kicked out of high school in 65. I capitalized on my father's declining health. He let me join the Army when I was 17 without a high school diploma. I was sent to basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, a.k.a. Fort Puke. I couldn't take it. I faked a nervous breakdown. I got kicked out. I was draft exempt and free white in 17 in the summer of 1965, came back to L.A. and started getting in trouble.
All right. That's interesting.
Minor trouble. Never anything too bad.
I didn't think you mind me asking that. I was just always curious about that.
Yeah.
Because that was I mean, everybody has a story from that time. So I'm just curious. You know, you either went, you didn't go, things happened.
Right.
So Blood's a Rover.
Let's
get back to the book for a bit here. Because I just think it really is an amazing story. And these characters are just amazing. Wayne Tedrow.
Wayne Tedrow.
Oh, you want to call him Tedrow, but it's Tedrow, I'm sure.
That's Tedrow, correct. Yeah, Tedrow. Yes.
Scion of the strange family life.
Strange father, real estate entrepreneur father. Yeah. Man who's made a lot of money pushing hate tracts. Man tangentially involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King in April of 1968. Las Vegas land baron. And all around bad guy. Wayne was a sergeant on Las Vegas Police Department. He's a chemist. He's a tormented guy.
A real tormented guy.
Yeah.
Wayne Tedrow Jr.
Yeah, Wayne Tedrow Jr., yeah.
And his dad was a piece of work.
His dad was a piece of something else you could describe, too.
Yes. So yeah. These people, how many people do you know that come out of this deeply kind of haunted racist Klan kind of world? Do you know these folks? Are they in your head or do you know them?
I just make it up. I have the ability to envision the private infrastructure of big public events. My imagination has worked toward the point of writing Blood's a Rover for decades and decades. That's what a lot of people don't understand. I do very little formal research. I ignore the culture around me and I go off in my head to do this.
But you didn't go do this research in Haiti and Dominican Republic. You had someone else do that.
I sent somebody to the Dominican Republic. Haiti is quite perilous. Travelers are advised to avoid the place. But I've seen pictures, and I can extrapolate fictionally off of fact sheets and create verisimilitude.
So, but you read history.
I have read history copiously. I understand 20th century American history and the criminal history of Los Angeles very well. And I know when to digress fictionally. And frankly, the answer is most of the time. I will tell you 90% of Blood's a Rover is fictional, yet the facts are entirely true.
Now, the reason I want to talk about Tedrow for a minute is because, I mean, this thing with Tedrow and he falls in love in the book, and there's a guy who keeps killing black people right and left, comes out of the world of the Klan with his father, falls in love with a black woman in the book.
Right.
And let me explore this. Let me explore race with you for you and your writing in this. Let's start with Walter.
Right.
With Wayne, I mean to say. Wayne Tedrow.
Right.
I mean, race is a complex thing in this country. And I want to talk about your approach to that from your own head and how you look at it.
Right.
Because people have accused you of all kinds of things. You've been accused of being a racist. You've been accused of being a homophobe. You've been accused of lots of stuff. But I really want to just talk about where you see this. I mean, you see the humanist in this Klan guy. You see the humanist in Marsh, this black cop. You talk about people in the street who are black like they're kind of vermin in some ways, the way you describe it. So let me talk to you about what it is, what's inside of you about all that.
Well, first of all, it's not me describing them. There are three viewpoints that begin this book, and two of the viewpoints are racist. So when you're in Dwight Hawley's tormented racist viewpoint, and he feels very guilty about his part in the MLK hit, it's all filtered through that guilt. He's in love with a left-wing woman, and he knows that racism is wrong. So he uses, in third-person subjective, racial epithets vehemently.
Right.
Don Crutchfield, the second protagonist, is just a dumb kid who doesn't know any better. So he uses racial epithets routinely in the third-person subjective. Lane Tedrow is in love with a black woman, has a tortured, tormented relationship with blacks, keeps stumbling into contexts where he kills these people, and would never use the words. Every chapter in this book is third-person subjective.
Mm-hmm.
That device mandates every expression of race. There is no James Ellroy in this book. I serve the characters. Also, PCers want all their racism described as a defining characteristic, whereas in my books, it's a casual attribute. People don't know how to feel when characters they are supposed to dig, characters who are on voyages of self-discovery, say vile things routinely.
That's because maybe a lot of people don't want to deal with the reality of what people really do when they're not in front of other people that who know them.
People often don't want to think. So I force them to think. People have two choices when they pick up Bloods or Rover. Think, ponder its meaning, or miss the point.
So you just said something. You said there's no James Ellroy in this book. I from things I've read that you've done before, essays, your memoir, it feels like there's a lot of James Ellroy in this book.
There is. I'm talking about pertaining to race.
Okay.
I'm talking about pertaining to bias in my case. Racial language is deployed very, very, very rigorously in this book. And when the three men, Hawley, Tedrow, and Crutchfield, converge in Haiti and a Holocaust occurs, there is no racial invective for the last 40% of the book.
That's right.
Because they come out of it ashamed and chagrined and changed men. There's a lot of me in this book because I used to be a peeper and Crutchfield's a peeper. And I used to be a panty sniffer and Crutchfield's a panty sniffer. And I used to perv around L.A. and Crutchfield pervs around L.A.
And you used to be in love with a woman on the left.
I was in love with a woman on the left, yeah.
Deeply.
Yeah.
I find that love affair in this book to be fascinating. Because if people...
You're talking about Joan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Joan or Karen, either one of them. I mean, they're both, because to me, the reality there is, and Wayne and Hazard.
Right.
Who's a black woman, and he comes out of the Klan world, the complexities of love and attraction and sex and romance go beyond all of our preconceived notions of race and everything else you would like to think about.
Yes, it's a very ideologically enmeshed, contradictory world. I would never say confused because these people are trying too hard to sort it all out. Marsh Bowen, who is the black cop whose diary excerpts are included, he's been sent in by the feds to infiltrate black militant groups, talks about living in a dream state. It's also a concept that the brilliant Wayne Tedrow, who befriends Marsh briefly, has. And it comes back to William Butler Yeats's term, the spiritus mundi, the collective unconsciousness. And this is where America was in 68 to 72. These kinds of freewheeling concepts were being discussed routinely. People were giving a lot of thought to what all this shit meant. You and me included, and the characters in Bloods of Rover are not afraid to talk about it. So it's my most ideological book. It's my most spiritual book. It's my most religious book.
This is, I mean, it felt that way. And it felt like this is also like a Bloods or Rover is part of your path over the last 40 years.
Yeah, it's my cosmology. Absolutely.
And I, you know, the way you talk about the power of, in terms of ideology and political power, of J. Edgar Hoover, as you like to call him, Gay Edgar Hoover, and that world, the power of, I know you don't read papers, you're not into the world that's going on today, so you can't put that on you for this book, but in many ways, the power of a small group of whoever they are is huge in society. People don't quite understand the power of a group that has maybe a minority basis in the society can do a lot of damage.
It's correct. That's correct. And it's a collusive, symbiotic relationship and a series of them that inform the text of Blood's a Rover. The FBI needs renegade black militant groups to survive. They need the larger ticket black militant groups heavily infiltrated by FBI agents and police agents, us and the Black Panthers, to survive. The intelligence community needs the mob. The political establishment needs the mob. One hand washes the other. Everybody is a cutout, an asset, or a snitch.
Now, again, let me go back to something we talked a little earlier about Blood's a Rover, because the characters and kind of where the lines always blurred for me, and when I realized some people were real and some were not. This guy Crutch is a real life friend of yours, as we talked.
He's a real life buddy of mine. People can find him on pi4stars.com. We got to be buddies in the late 90s, and he had some good shit pertaining to the old LA that even I couldn't have invented. So I made him a financial offer to appear in the book as the ultimate hero. He agreed. We have an agreement. I said, Crutch, stuff you did do, stuff you didn't do. We put it all together in the mix master of my twisted soul, and it comes out on the page, and you're going to dig it. And he does.
And I think that the Wayne Tedrow character, again, moving to him for a minute again, I mean, he was, I felt his kind of getting more and more exhausted, more and more stretched to the end, that he was somebody who was just so physically, spiritually, morally exhausted from his journey. I'm surprised he could survive what he did.
Well, the epigraph that gives me the title, Blood's a Rover, is from A.E. Hausman, and it was written 90-odd years ago. The aftermath of World War I, clay lies still, but blood's a rover, breath's aware that will not keep. Up, lad, when the journey's over, there'll be time enough for sleep. You hit it right on the head, moral exhaustion. That's a big, big theme of this book.
A lot of morally exhausted people in this book.
There's a lot of morally exhausted people in this book, but they can still get it up to go out and do the bad boogaloo. Because these guys are looking for love. And this is a book about bad men in love with strong women. And you got some doozy strong women in this book.
What you love,
some doozy bad men.
Would you love that? You love strong women.
I dig that shit. I gotta have it. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. You can't. Strong women are the only thing in life that'll challenge you.
That's right. That's correct.
And all these women here. I mean, because you can start this book and think, okay, well, here we go with James Ellroy, and he's going to give us all these tough ass men and who are bad, as you put it. You know,
bad
men who go. You know who you get in there, but. You have to really get into it to understand what you're saying about the women.
Right.
The power of the women in this book.
This book, I don't want to give too much away.
No, I'm not going to give the details away. No.
It becomes a matriarchy. It becomes a lost boy, which is symbolically me, entering a matriarchy.
And these women.
That's unheralded, unprecedented in my work.
I I love that scene, which we won't talk too much in detail about, but when Crutch tips in on the two women.
Right. Early on.
I get going, okay, I have to know more about who these two women are. Who are these women?
You're talking about Karen Zafakis and Joan Klein.
No, I'm talking about,
Gretchen Celia.
Yeah.
And the woman with the dark gray streaked hair.
Yes.
The dark gray streaked hair is Joan Klein.
Yes.
The other woman, Gretchen.
The red goddess.
Joan is the red goddess.
Joan is the red goddess.
Yeah, Joan is the red goddess. She's based on a woman I was with in San Francisco several years ago, and it went bad. It was good until it was bad.
That's how it goes. And,
yeah. Karen Zafakis was based on a married woman I had a wing ding with. It was good until it went bad. And we remained friends. And I want to state, in case, you know, all this shit ends up on the internet, that I'm deeply in love now with a woman who's eclipsed all women in my past.
It's a good thing.
Because, you know how it is. You cut a fart in Chicago and it ends up on someone's computer screen in L.A.
Oh, yeah, you can't. This is a different world.
Erica, darling, I want you to know that I said this during this radio interview.
And he meant it.
And you mean it, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But,
so that's, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, those two women, what can I say? It was good till it went bad. And you turn it into fiction. You exploit the misfortune in your life. You exploit the misalliance. You exploit the good shit gone bad. And you turn it into fiction. What do you want to do? You want to live, you want to learn, you want to grow as an artist. You know, you want to write a book that bites somebody's bad boogaloo. That's what I want to do. Bring people closer to God. That's what I want to do.
Bring people closer to God. A lot of people are makers in these books as well.
They do.
A lot. You have people writing a lot of, there's a lot of stuff in here with journals and letters. There's Marsh's journals. There's Karen Zafakis' journals. There's the letters from Joan. That takes up an entire chunk of the book.
The book is an epistolary novel, and in the prologue, the narrator, and we know who that becomes ultimately, talks about usurped public files and private journals, and he is both a literary executor and an agent provocateur. This is the analog age. It's the pre-digital age, and it was all files. What happened to J. Edgar Hoover's files? Does he have paper on me? And so this young man is a file keeper. He is a hoarder of paper. There's a lot of metaphor in that. So he builds the story from much later in life. And at the end of the book, we realize the extent to which this book is his construction. So it's a book within a book.
J. Edgar Hoover. Now, when you were, did they have files on you? Do you ever look at your own files from Hoover's day?
Nah, Hoover never had files on me. I was a Mickey Mouse misdemeanant from L.A.
If he was alive today, he'd have files on you.
No, even he would know that I was too pathetic to have a file. And Fred Oakash, private eye to the stars and a buddy of mine in the declining years of his life, was dismayed that Shakedown Freddy himself only had a 3-page FBI sheet. Huh. Of course, he's a character in this book.
He is a character in this book.
Yeah, Fred Oetash.
The Lebanese man.
Lebanese.
Not quite white.
He's white.
But no,
he's
doesn't white. He say that?
He had a giant schlong. I mean, he would tell you that he had a giant schlong.
But he describes himself as nice. I'm not white. I'm Lebanese. I think he's one of the lines.
Yeah, I'm
white.
I'm Lebanese. Yeah, I'm a well-hung Lebanese. I'm well-hung American of Lebanese descent, he says.
So besides the intrigue, I want to get to some of the intrigue in this book and the conspiracy stuff that goes on. It's just the way you write, your style of writing. I want to get to that. But these characters, the amount of drugs and alcohol these guys consume, is mind-boggling. I mean,
yeah.
For those people who grew up in the 60s, you know, people are used to doing a lot of drinking, a lot of drugs.
Right.
At least a segment of that world that we were part of.
Right.
But these guys, I mean, the amount of stuff and the kinds of things they mix, the amphetamines, the booze, all the rest.
The voodoo herbs in Haiti.
The voodoo herbs in Haiti.
That was zombify your ass.
I mean, so you must have done your own research at some point in life.
Never took voodoo herbs, been sober for many years.
I know you have now.
My very capable researcher, Kateri Butler, put together a primer for me on Haitian chemistry. It's all realistic.
Uh-huh.
And there are characters in this book who indulge in zombification, self-zombification, blowfish toxins, crushed free trog livers, all kinds of stuff that you and I wouldn't even have considered taking in the summer of love.
So how long have you been sober?
A total of 32 years.
32 years. You mind if I ask you about that?
Well, if I don't have to reveal to him, just ask.
Not too much. I'm just curious. Your reasons for getting there. How you got to that place for 32 years, which you became clean and sober.
I turned my life and will over to the power of God as I understood Him. I'm a religious guy. I'm on the spiritual path. I'm always trying to be better. And if I use drugs or drink alcohol, I won't have a life that's worth a shit. I won't be able to accomplish anything. Women won't love me. So I really had no other alternatives.
That's interesting. So, and I think in many ways, people who have gone through this stuff, a lot of serious drugs and alcohol in their lives, who have been down near the bottom, yeah, and have this creative stuff inside of them that they have to get out.
Yes.
I think the only way to really get it out, any semblance of sanity, whatever that means, is to put this stuff down.
Total abstinence, yes.
Because where does the energy come from to write a novel like this without that?
Right. And it's part of the compact job of God.
Interesting. So there are people who, you know, if you read some reviews about your books, and people can criticize the way you write in short staccato sentences.
No, this is actually, anybody who says that I write that way in this book would be wrong, because this is a more fully explicated style, deliberately so, because there's greater emotional content in this book.
There is.
Yeah.
No, I think these characters are, I've read some of the debates in some of the reviews of the books. I read the book, but I also read the reviews to see what people are saying. And the idea that some people think that the characters in this book are not well developed is, I don't quite understand it, because I think these characters.
Those are just all the newspaper reviews, the big newspaper reviews that I've read have been glowing. You know, you never know what some dipshit's going to say on the internet. Bloggers? What's a blogger?
What is a blogger?
I'm asking.
I don't know. I
think internet pundit. Internet pundit.
Which
means
you see nothing.
Right.
And you managed to survive all this time in your work and your writing without falling into that world at all.
I have an assistant who goes on Facebook and who sends emails for me, but I would never voluntarily look at a computer. Sometimes I look at the screen with her sitting beside me. She folds up her computer and lets me look at it. We send messages to people on Facebook. And Alfred A. Knopf, king of American publishers, made me get a page on Facebook. And once these series of book tours in Great Britain, Europe, et al., are concluded, that's it.
That's it? What do you mean that's it?
That's it for computers and me.
You're done. There's no
more. Until my new book comes out next year, I'll go back on it.
Got it.
Yeah.
So I think it's really interesting that the people I meet who can completely divorce themselves from this age.
I do the best I can. I walk around in this age. I'm anxious enough as it is. I don't have to exacerbate that condition by talking into cell phones. I unplug. I avoid imagery. I avoid kineticism. I don't like going into restaurants and seeing TV screens. Or hearing music. I don't like music in elevators. I don't like noise.
Let me go back to some of these characters again and talk about what they do. And I love your portrayal of Howard Hughes in this book.
Yeah, he's hilarious. 6'3", 110, dope fiend, long claws, unkempt. Gets transfusions of germ-free Mormon blood every day. Xenophobic, racist, claustrophobic, who knows?
Germ-free Mormon blood.
Yeah.
But you really paint a picture of our Mormon brethren in a very special way in this book.
Just about good Mormons. They're just not in my book. plenty of good Mormons. Just not the ones in my book.
What?
A lot of great cops. I love cops.
You do love cops.
Yearly MC. I do love cops. They're my people. I'm the MC of the Jack Webb Awards every year for LAPD. But good cops often make for bad fiction.
So given all you've gone through, tell me why you have a love affair with cops.
I love order. I think people should be good to each other. I would rather live in a society that errs on the side of authoritarianism than a society that errs on the side of permissiveness.
So,
like a nice, tightly controlled society, free of bad behavior, free of imagery, free of dipshit kids on cell phones, free of rude behavior, horn honking, hyperkineticism. I like a nice, quiet, well-behaved society. But sometimes I think you got to cut cops loose and let them kick some ass.
So
they kicked my ass, LAPD did. I learned. It's the only thing that ever taught me. Good ass kicking.
But then if we had that kind of world, man, what would you write about?
The past. The past. I'd live in a utopian future and write about a more unruly past, but a past that I could contain between hardcovers.
So when you write about the conspiracies between the mob and others and the FBI to take out King, to take out Kennedys, the Kennedys, but that's all part of, isn't that part of the contradiction of that authoritarian world when you have this kind of world where people can do that? Isn't that part of it as well? Isn't that the...
It's not a contradiction because I'm writing about 1968 to 1972 here and we're living in 2009. And I had a different response to the world in 1968 than I do in 2009. And Blood's a Rover is not meant to be a work that in any way references contemporary America. It was written contemporaneously,
right.
But I was not thinking about America today when I wrote it. I was deliberately ignoring America today so that I might live in America then.
But you continue to ignore it. That world
I will
today
go
around
to the
you.
Airport tomorrow and fly to New York. I will bomb around Chicago where this interview is being conducted from today. Look at people. I will get back to the hotel room. I'm sure the cleaning woman will have turned on the TV set. I will turn it off. I will lie down on the bed. I will shut off all the lights and brood.
And brood.
Brood.
And brood. And brood yields the books.
Brooding time, time alone in the dark. I often listen to classical music. Gives me the silence. Gives me the emotional and imaginative wherewithal to live in big swatches of years gone by.
And your books, I mean, this one is like, this series is like historical fiction.
Right.
Married to the great American crime novel.
It's very much what it is. It's more historical novel than crime novel. The antecedents of this book are all self-referential. My L.A. Quartet, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. The Underworld USA Trilogy, American Tabloid, The Cult 6000, and now Blood's a Rover. I've been on an evolutionary path. I started out writing contemporary set, small crime novels, mysteries, if you'd have it that way. And my intentions have grown, my personal ambitions have grown, my rigor has grown, my style has evolved, and I'm always looking inward for a larger, more important story to tell.
And they do come tumbling out, I think, in this trilogy. I mean, I have all the things I love this trilogy. I mean, I think that that's, in some ways, maybe the pinnacle of your writing. The others might have been made into great movies, but this is, or not how great they were, but they've been made into movies.
Yes. Yes, I agree. I agree. This is the work.
So what you're coming up with next is more of a memoir than a novel.
My memoir, The Hilliker Curse, subtitled My Pursuit of Women, is out in the April, June, September issues of Playboy. People can find it. And it's coming at the conclusion in the November issue of Playboy on sale October 10th. And then the longer, much more detailed book-length version will be published by Alfred A. Knopf next fall, concurrent with Blood's a Rover and paperback.
I must admit I haven't done my homework. I have not read the Playboy series yet, but I intend to. I want to read it. That's why I can't ask you any questions about it, because I don't know what you said.
That's okay. Let's talk about Bloods Are Over.
We can't do that. We can talk about Bloods Are Over. Which is, so this, also this book is, it's so full of a twisted, connected, around the corner, curveball madness. The connections between people that you don't expect. How things about, it's this connectedness.
It's about emerging societies. It's about emerging communities. It's about clash, black and white, gay and straight, left and right, Jew and Christian, atheist and believer, boozer and dope fiend. It's about interconnectedness and the collective unconscious. And everybody, or at least Wayne Tedrow Jr., Marshall Bowen, Dwight Hawley, Don Crutchfield, Karen Safakis, and Joan Rosenkline, has a rap about it. Seven people, iconic, representative of their time, fully emblematic, speak in this book. And we get to know what's on their minds.
Except for Crutch, a lot of the people who are involved in the heart of this 60s stuff are older than most of the people that are involved in the 60s stuff, right?
Yeah. There are people in their 40s and in their 50s, and they have, in the case of Dwight Hawley, come to the force of conversion late. But, yes, they are older rather than younger, with the exception of Don Crutchfield.
So what I'm saying was interesting to me is that the embodiment of all this stuff in the 60s, whether it was the Klan stuff or whether it was Karen or Joan's revolutionary left-wing world or Dwight and Wayne's world, these are worlds that came out more of our father's and uncle's generation than the generation of the 60s.
It's about people in early middle age coming to grips with their actions and riding the zeitgeist. And so the youth culture of the time is hardly referenced at all. For one thing, I've never had an affinity for rock and roll.
Uh-huh.
You know, I have no more interest in the Beatles or Rolling Stones or Bob Dylan than I have with having sex with a porcupine. And thus my characters don't. Someone asked me recently, why isn't there anything about the British Revolution? The British invasion
right,
here.
Right.
And my answer is because I don't give a shit. And neither do my characters. Because it happened in Great Britain.
But what you did do, what you do with these characters who have fought in World War II or been through Korea or been in the airborne in the late 50s, who have been part of the radical movement of the 30s and 40s, is have them play out the 60s battle, but with a history of coming from an older place is what I'm talking about, which is different than I've seen. I don't think I've ever kind of, until this moment, I really didn't think about the fact that I don't think I've read a novel about the 60s that's done that.
They are people in their physical maturity who realize, oh, man, there's another world out there, and I'd better get me some.
One of the things that a cop once said to me was that that criminals and cops are the same people. We just happen to tip to the other side for whatever reason in life. We're a cop and I'm not a thug.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at your character, and I thought about this. This guy, Tor DeLabo, was a policeman for 35 years and a really great guy. Told me that. He used to bust people. And after I gave him my funny lines, that's how he used to bust them. That's another story. But what reminds me of that is that your characters like Wayne Tedrow, Dwight Hawley, remind me of that. They could have easily been a thug as much as they were a cop, and maybe were a bit of both anyway.
They are soldiers of fortune. They are rogue cops. Most cops could not have become anything else. So I don't buy the old saw that there's just one gene missing between a hitman for the mob and an especially gung-ho police officer. I think that's a little bit too convenient. But with my guys, it's certainly true. And when law enforcement goes bad for them, there's no place else to go but down. Well, I hate criminals and I love cops.
Well, but Wayne and Dwight, very different men.
Mm-hmm. Age gap.
Mm-hmm. But isn't that who they are on some levels? Aren't they those guys who are walking a very thin line that way in this novel?
They want to be redeemed. I'm a Christian. I look at Blood's a Rover as a Christian document. It's about salvation. It's about redemption. It's about virtue as its own reward. It's about moral exhaustion and craving the next right thing because you're a drowning man and you need air. You're a man dying of thirst and you need a drink of water.
But the violence and conspiracy in this book, the ground tread between a Dwight Holly and his life with J. Edgar Hoover, his relationship with J. Edgar Hoover.
Yes.
And how that pulls in a Wayne Tedrow who's much more across the line in terms of his criminality.
Right.
Than Dwight. This is a very intense world. It's very, you don't know what's going to happen next. You're driven by this drama with this thing. But is this how you see who we are in terms of our world? Is this how it works?
To one degree or another, but these are not novels that purport to be about the world the way it is in its totality. This is about a world that contains the phenomenon that I call the life. Uh-huh. Rogue police elements, political operators, Klan guys, snitches, cutouts, professional paid information gatherers, surveillance experts, private eyes, rogue fuzz, infiltrators, dubious politicos of all stripes. It's what I call the life. This book is not about you and me. It's not about me writing about them. It's not about you interviewing me. It's not even about, except tangentially, America as a whole. When I go to Europe for 6 weeks in the winter to promote this book in 6 different countries, I will have to explain this to people. And at the outset, I will say, don't say anything bad about America. It has nothing to do with Bush, the war in Iraq, Obama, anything else. I wrote the book in a vacuum. You get it? I can answer any question about 68 to 72. Talk about the times up the yin-yang. Ascribe meaning across a broad physical, psychological, spiritual, metaphysical spectrum. But I'm not a pundit or critic of my country today, and I ignore the contemporary world, which is where the power of the book derives from.
It does, and it's the power of both the price people pay and the salvation they seek and find, and it written around the power of this really great. It really is a mystery and a piece of historical fiction. And I got to tell you, I want to thank you so much for taking your time. This has been phenomenal.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Steiner.
It's been great. James Ellroy, Blood's a Rover, his latest work. Don't miss it and don't miss him. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Again, a pleasure.